Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. Whether you are a student prepping for tests and boards or a CRNA here to earn CEUs, we are glad you've joined us. For more about us, make sure to check us out on Instagram at Core Anesthesia and online at coreanesthesia.com.
Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. I'm Cole here with Tanner, and today we're going to move our discussion into the realm of renal anesthesia, specifically talking about how our anesthetic is going to be altered for patients that have acute renal failure or chronic renal failure. And then we'll also talk about some of the alterations and electrolyte abnormalities that we can see and some of the things that would change in terms of our treatment, in terms of if we would do anesthesia on those patients. So before we jump into the acute renal failure and chronic renal failure, we're going to go through a brief review of the anatomy so that we can better understand the disease process when we see the altered physiology that happens. So Tanner, do you just want to start us off here with basic anatomy and physiology of a normal kidney?
Yeah, remember that we tend to think of kidneys as being pretty sensitive. And one of the reasons for that is that they get about 20% of the cardiac output via the renal arteries. So those will break down into afferent arterioles that will go to each nephron. Remember, the nephron is the smallest functional unit of the kidney. And those afferent arterioles will flow into the capillary bed inside the Bowman capsule. And that is going to form the glomerulus. This is where we're going to filter fluid, small molecules, ions into the tubular system. And then whatever isn't filtered, so think of like large molecules, cells, those will flow into the efferent arterial, which will then flow into the paratubular capillary bed. So that's going to be the blood flow that's going around the tubular system. And that's where you'll see reabsorption, secretion, and we'll talk about, you know, kind of why that's important or the different things that are being reabsorbed or secreted there in the tubular system. The renal system can regulate blood flow and the filtration rate of the glomerulus. This is known as GFR. Normal GFR is 125 mils per minute. And the body is able to keep a normal GFR if we have a systolic blood pressure between 80 and 180. I mentioned this at the beginning, we tend to think of them as being a little sensitive because it's not able to regulate the GFR outside of this range. And also just remember, just from a cardiac output standpoint, we're getting quite a bit here, 20% of the cardiac output that's going to the renal arteries. When we're talking about filtering blood from the glomerulus into the tubular system, typically the more blood flow that goes into the glomerulus and stays there, the more that will be filtered. So the longer that the blood is, it's not stationary, but the longer that it's there and able to be, you know, presented to the tubular system, the more that you'll see more filtration. So if we have a dilated afferent arteriole, so we'll have more blood flow coming to the glomerulus, this will improve the amount of filtration that happens there at the glomerulus. Prostaglandins cause afferent arterial dilation. You can also see your NSAIDs, your non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, will block this process of the prostaglandins causing that arterial dilation. And so you'll see arterial constriction. This is one of the reasons that when we're talking about patients that have reduced kidney function, we want to be very sensitive with the NSAIDs that we are giving. And again, this is primarily because it's going to counteract those prostaglandins that typically would cause dilation in the afferent arteriole, and you'll see arterial constriction there on the afferent side. On the other side of things, thromboxane A2, which is going to be at the end of the prostaglandin synthesis cascade, will cause an afferent arterial constriction. So the sympathetic nervous system can also cause afferent vasoconstriction, which will also reduce blood flow to the glomerulus as well. When we're talking about the efferent arteriole, again, the whole concept we're trying to keep in mind here is the longer that the blood is staying in that glomerulus, the longer it'll have a chance to have filtration. So we've talked about we can dilate the afferent arteriole. Well, now let's talk about the efferent arteriole. So on the other side of it, more blood will stay there in the glomerulus if we have a constriction there on the efferent side. So vasopressin is going to cause efferent arterial constriction, and that will improve or increase your GFR simply by constricting that efferent side. The distal tubule will wrap back around and comes in close proximity to the Bowman's capsule. which is the juxtaglomerular complex. This is really important because this is where you will find your macula densa. This is where your renin is released from. So when you're talking about your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, this will be very important in that situation, in that process where you have these macula densa cells. So if you have a decrease in GFR, this is going to cause more sodium and chloride to be absorbed from the ascending loop of Henle, which will show low sodium and chloride at the macula densa cells. So when the macula densa cells see that we have a low sodium, low chloride, then they're going to signal the afferent arteriole to dilate, which will then increase blood flow and subsequently GFR. So to keep that in mind, when we, this is the loop that we're talking about. If you have decreased GFR, then you have more sodium and chloride to be absorbed, and that's going to be at the ascending loop of Henle. But remember, that comes in a close proximity there at the juxtaglomerular complex. The macula densa cells, they're going to see the lower sodium, lower chloride, and because of that feedback loop, they're going to signal afferent arterial dilate. And again, that's going to increase your GFR. Like I mentioned earlier, this will also cause the macula densa cells to secrete renin, which makes angiotensinogen from the liver to turn into angiotensin 1. In the lung, angiotensin 1 will make angiotensin 2 in the presence of the angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE. We'll talk about this in other episodes, but remember that we're talking about ACE inhibitors. This is where we're having the effect there. Many of our patients will come in on that. And we talked about in previous episodes where if you're having an issue with hypotension in a patient with an ACE inhibitor, you need to give vasopressin. And this is part of the reason here, understanding how vasopressin works, understanding where this ACE inhibitors are working. Back to here, though, we're talking about angiotensin 2 that will cause efferent arterial constriction. And remember, we're talking about that's on the other side of the glomerulus compared to the afferent. So afferent, you talk about dilating to have increased GFR, efferent constriction. So angiotensin 2 will cause efferent arterial constriction, subsequently increased GFR. So to summarize, renin is released due to low blood flow to the kidney, and that is going to be triggered there by that decrease in sodium and decrease in chloride in that distal tubule. You can also see that the sympathetic nervous system will stimulate renin via the beta 1 receptors. But again, keep this all in mind as we're talking about different functions or different issues later in this talk. We need to understand the actual anatomy and physiology here to begin with. One more thing I wanted to mention here is GFR is also based on osmotic and hydrostatic pressures as well. So when we think about osmotic pressure is going to be related to how much protein there is. And this basically acts as a magnet for the fluid. Hydrostatic pressure is a pressure or fluid that is trying to leave the space that it's in. So when we're talking about the glomerulus, the more protein that we have in the plasma, the less likely fluid is going to be to leave and be filtered out there. So GFR there, the more protein we have in the plasma. The longer we keep the fluid in the glomerular capsule, you're going to have an increase in the hydrostatic pressure. Remember, hydrostatic pressure is the fluid trying to leave the space that it's in. So the longer that we have that hydrostatic pressure build up there, the fluid is going to want to filter into the tubular space. We should also take note that surgery can cause vasoconstriction just simply by activating the SNS. So there can be a sodium retention seen with oliguria for several days after surgery. A result is you would see a patient with edema because of this initial SNS stimulation.
So next we want to continue our discussion through normal physiology and anatomy. Let's talk about the tubular flow. So once fluid has filtered across now, from that glomerulus and that capsule, it's now into the nephron and we're in the tubular system. It goes then through at first the proximal tubule, and then it will dip down into the renal medulla to form what's called the loop of Henle. And then it will come back up into the renal cortex and then through the distal tubule and lastly into the collecting duct, which then will connect with other nephron collecting ducts to flow into the renal pelvis and ultimately the ureter. So that's the track that it'll follow once it gets filtered into this tubular space. But now while it's doing that, while it's flowing through there, fluid can be reabsorbed by going from the tubule space back into the paratubular capillaries. So there's a network of capillaries that run next to this tubular flow that allows for that fluid to be reabsorbed. 99, and you heard me right, 99% of the filtered fluid will get reabsorbed. So only 1% ends up turning into urine. I mean, thankfully, because otherwise we'd have to walk around with Foley bags our whole life because we would be producing so much urine and honestly, we wouldn't be able to stay hydrated. So 99% of what gets filtered ultimately gets reabsorbed. Now, secretion, when we say secretion, that is when you have ions and molecules that were not originally filtered from the glomerulus into this tubular space that is now being able to come from those paratubular capillaries and diffuse through that membrane or go through different channels or openings in order to get into that tubule. So that's what we call secretion, anything that gets secreted into that space during this tubular flow. And then excretion is what is left in the tubular system at the end of it, and ultimately then becomes urine. So that's what we say is excreted from the kidneys, is anything that's left over. So you initially have whatever is filtered into that fluid. Some of that, or most of that, is reabsorbed, but you also have some things that are secreted. And at the very end, whatever's left is what we say is excreted. So let's break it down now. In the proximal tubule, there's 65% of the sodium that'll be reabsorbed in this part of the tubule, in the proximal tubule. And that's all due to via active transport mechanisms. Water, electrolytes, organic substances, they're all going to be co-transported here with that sodium. And in exchange for that, hydrogen ions are going to be secreted that are now going into the tubular flow. So you have sodium being absorbed back in and hydrogen being excreted out. Now, water is going to passively transport across the membrane back into the plasma due to the oncotic pressure in the capillaries. So as Tanner talked about, it acts as a magnet, all those proteins, like all the albumin and other proteins that are in the plasma that are going to act as a magnet and pull that water across the membrane back into the plasma. Bicarbonate is also going to be absorbed here, and then uric acid and toxins will be secreted in the proximal tubule. And then lastly, glucose and proteins that make it into the filtrate, like amino acids, vitamins, all of that are then completely reabsorbed here by active processes. So any of that that does get put into the filtrate, into this tubular flow from the glomerulus will ultimately get reabsorbed, hopefully, back at this point. When we get down to the loop of Henle, the goal is to establish a hyperosmotic state. So you have this countercurrent of blood flow and these blood vessels going the exact opposite direction as this loop of Henle. And so if you can envision the loop of Henle starting on the left, it drops down, curves around to the right, and comes back up. You have a countercurrent blood vessel known as the vasorecta, which is starting in the top right, going down, flowing then to the left and then back up. So the opposite flow. And it's trying to get water to be reabsorbed throughout this loop. And so 20% of the water is absorbed here in the descending part of the loop. And by doing that, by the time you get to the bottom, the tubular concentration is now up to 1500 milliosmoles per liter. And then it curves back into that thick ascending segment. And that's where sodium, potassium, and chloride are all actively pumped out of the tubule. But this region is impermeable to water. So in the descending section, we were just reabsorbing tons of water. But now we have this thick ascending segment, which is impermeable to water, and we're getting all the sodium, potassium, and chloride to be actively pumped back out. So now the filtrate comes back to a hypotonic solution now. And then hydrogen as well is excreted in exchange for sodium again here. Then we get to the distal tubule. And then you have sodium, potassium, chloride, and bicarb are all reabsorbed here. And aldosterone carries out its function in this part of the tubule. And the parathyroid hormone will increase calcium reabsorption here as well. This is the site of that. And then we get to the collecting duct. And the collecting duct is where antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, that's where that's going to work. And it's going to allow water only to be reabsorbed. And then you have the atrial natriuretic peptide, AMP, which works here to inhibit water and sodium reabsorption. And this is also the site for last minute hydrogen adjustment as well. So if you're sticking with me through all of this, you might have to go back and listen to that one or two more times. But basically, each section of the nephron is very specific in terms of how it reabsorbs and secretes certain ions, molecules, water, etc. And it all does that. So when we get to different forms of diuretics, they all act on different points of that process. And we have another episode where we walk through the actual pharmacology of diuretics. So I encourage you to go listen to that. We're not going to cover that here today. But that's where you kind of now get a better understanding of where all of those are going to act and how they're going to act. So now renal labs. The first is what we've been talking a lot about, and that is the glomerular function, and that's measured by GFR. And Tanner has talked a lot about that so far. We're going to get into that a little bit more when we get to this acute kidney injury and chronic kidney failure. Another one is blood urea nitrogen, BUN, and it's a product of protein metabolism from the liver. So urea undergoes filtration and then reabsorption. And when a patient is dehydrated, less fluid is going to move through the tubular system, which means that more of that urea can be reabsorbed, which results in a higher serum level. So if you think about it, if the kidneys are pumping a lot of fluid through those tubular spaces, there's not as much time then for that urea to be reabsorbed. But when you have less fluid getting sent through that tubular space, you give it more time to be reabsorbed. So that's why patients that have an elevated BUN show to us then that they're most likely dehydrated. If the BUN is above 50 milligrams per deciliter, most likely there is a decreased GFR as well here. Creatinine, CR, is a metabolic product of skeletal muscle breakdown, and it only undergoes filtration. So it's better than the BUN to assess for the GFR function, but both can be used. But it's important to note that in an elderly population, they may have a normal creatinine level, even with kidney failure, because they have less muscle mass that's being broken down. So just kind of keep that in mind. We also have fractional excretion of sodium, specific gravity, and urine osmolality. They all look at the urine components themselves, and they're better estimates of tubular function. So if you're looking specifically for tubular function, that's where you should look at. And then lastly, patients should not have any protein in the urine. This, if they do have protein in the urine, this is the result of glomerular filtration cells having damage. That filtration network is not working appropriately if proteins are getting through there. So just know if you do have protein in the urine, that is a sign that you have some damage there.
All right. We've talked about the anatomy. We've talked about some physiology, talked about some labs, about, you know, what we should be looking for in terms of a healthy kidney, or if we've seen some damage or some, you know, issues with the kidney. Let's move now into acute kidney injury and failure. Typically, you'll see this as AKI, acute kidney injury. I feel like that's how we normally will see it, you know, abbreviated notes and just as we're talking to one another. But what does that actually mean? You know, what are the labs that we're looking at to really define acute kidney injury? It's diagnosed based on your creatinine and your GFR status, along with urine output. And one of the reasons for this is, like Cole mentioned, with elderly patients, your creatinine can still look normal just simply because of a decreased muscle mass. And there's other reasons that you could have decreased urine output. You know, your GFR status could change as well. So really, we're looking at a picture, a complementary picture, looking at these different labs to make a diagnosis of acute kidney injury. So in order to be considered acute kidney injury, your creatinine needs to be 50% above baseline. So remember, this is creatinine is your waste. And so if you have an increase in your creatinine, this is because you're not excreting it. And so this is reason why you have an increase in creatinine. Or that could be another stipulation there is you could have greater than 0.3 milligrams per deciliter for your creatinine. Your GFR would be decreased by 25% with urine output of being less than 0.5 mils per kilograms per hour for about 6 hours. So when we're talking about the actual classification of acute kidney injury, it will revolve around the specific cause for the injury. So we're looking at pre-renal, intrinsic, and post-renal. Pre-renal, think of things like hypoperfusion to the kidneys, things like low blood volume. You could see this with congestive heart failure, sepsis, cirrhosis, severely vasoconstricting drugs. So you have a patient that's been on Levofed for a long time. These vasoconstricting drugs could cause this acute kidney injury simply because of decreased blood flow to the kidneys. If you have extreme vasoconstriction, or if you have really increased abdominal pressure, again, this could reduce the amount of blood flow that gets to the kidneys. So when we're thinking about treatment here, really we need to fix the root cause. There's nothing specifically with the kidneys that is an issue. There's nothing that is causing them to fail specifically, aside from the fact that we have pre-renal causes with this hypoperfusion. And that's where we need to focus our efforts to right that, which will then in turn fix the issues that we're seeing with the kidney. If we have an intrinsic injury, this is an issue with the actual kidney. So this would be damage or ischemia to the renal tissues. Medulla is going to be the most at risk here. Keep that in mind. This can be caused by things like nephrotoxic drugs. So think about your contrast dye, antibiotics, specifically Gent is a big offender here. Also, we talked about non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, your NSAIDs. Those can also be an offender here as well. You can also see this with infections, or if you have direct ischemia in the actual renal tissues. It's a little fuzzy compared to talking about the decreased blood flow. And is that really pre-renal or is that intrinsic? But this would be ischemia to the actual renal tissues that are causing the issue. Typically, this is seen as oliguria, but you can see both dilute and high sodium in the urine. So you can see both sides there with the actual urine. Post-renal injury, this is going to be due mainly to an obstruction in the urinary tract. So think about tumors or if you have a large hematoma. If you have issues with your prostate that are causing decreased ability to void, neurogenic bladder strictures, all those types of things will be post-renal. Again, similar to pre-renal in that we're not treating specifically the kidney. These are extrinsic things that are causing the, we'll still see the changes in the GFR, the urine output, the creatinine, but this is not specifically an issue with the kidney. This is an obstruction that's happening after the fact. So let's talk about if we have patients with AKI, how are we going to manage them from an anesthetic standpoint? The goal here really is to limit renal hypoperfusion during the perioperative setting. So you're going to want to maintain a good cardiac output, good renal perfusion to try to limit any hyperperfusion and any basically insult injury there already. To minimize ADH and your renin-angiotensin aldosterone secretion in your RAS system, you're going to want to make sure that you have adequate hydration in the preoperative setting. And you're going to, again, want to make sure that's done prior to induction of anesthesia to avoid having these systems ramp up and cause more issues. If we're doing a procedure where we're expecting a lot of blood loss or fluid loss, then you are going to want to get a really good handle on that in terms of how are you going to monitor these patients. So an A-line would be appropriate for these patients. Even a central venous pressure with a central line would be recommended as well to keep a very close eye on the fluid status. This is going to be very important when we're thinking about hypotension relating to dehydration as well. We're going to, again, we're trying to limit the amount of hypoperfusion. And so this is going to be potentially very key monitors to help us manage that. Another monitor that's going to be helpful is a urinary catheter that is placed. Adequate urine output during a case should be between 0.5 and 1 mils per kilo per hour. Remember, that was one of the stipulations when we're talking about acute kidney injury would be less than that 0.5 mils per kilos per hour. If you see a decrease here, you should initiate a 500 to a liter bolus would be a first step here for patients that have lower urinary output. Usually, if you have a patient that has severe renal compromise, then stick to a lower fluid bolus, give them 250 mils with these patients. You don't want to fluid overload them and cause other issues. But if you have a patient that does not have that extreme renal compromise, but you're seeing that decreased urinary output, then giving half a liter to a liter bolus is an effective choice. Diuretics is something that, you'll read with different sources, differing opinions and differing solutions regarding giving diuretics. The issue with diuretics is that you're not actually solving the issue with the chronic renal dysfunction. You're simply making more urine output. And so while the numbers might look better regarding how much that the patient is putting out, whatever the problem is with the patient or whatever the issue is that's causing the decreased urinary output, we're not fixing that by giving diuretics. We're simply getting a result. But some people and some sources will still say that it is a good choice to give for patients that are having decreased urinary output. Another one that is slightly controversial is dopamine. As you use it with higher doses, it will cause renal vasoconstriction, but at a lower dose, it seems to be renal protective and give you a little bit of a boost when it comes to getting that perfusion needed for urinary output. Overall, the key for treating acute kidney injury is early recognition and then correcting the reversible causes. So if we have, you know, if they're hypovolemic, then giving them fluid administration with normal saline. If we have an issue with hyperperfusion because of cardiac output, then we need to look at strategies that would improve cardiac output, whether that's reducing afterload or normalizing systemic vascular resistance. Whatever the core issue is there with the cardiac output being decreased, trying to normalize those things to try to get ahead and treat the acute kidney injury before it becomes worse. If the cause is due to post-renal obstruction, then you can place a bladder catheter or a nephrostomy tube can be placed to prevent the post-renal obstruction there. If the issue is intrarenal, this is going to be more difficult to diagnose and treat. But if it's being caused by glomerulonephritis or vasculitis, then you would place these patients on immunosuppressive therapy. That would be like a 2-week tapering of glucocorticoids. In severe cases, however, urgent hemodialysis will be necessary if the metabolic acidosis is too significant or unresponsive to the sodium bicarb infusions. This is where you'll see hyperkalemia develop, and obviously we're going to have issues there with cardiac arrhythmias. And so in those cases, then the patient would need dialysis.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by Nurse Anesthesia of Maine, where excellence meets compassion. Established in 2003, Nurse Anesthesia of Maine has grown into a dynamic team of 30-plus CRNAs, serving 12 hospitals and ASCs with exceptional anesthesia services. Nurse Anesthesia of Maine is seeking qualified nurse anesthesiologists to join their outstanding team with competitive salaries, a robust benefit package, flexible schedules, and a commitment to community involvement. Explore Bangor, Maine, a vibrant city surrounded by stunning outdoor landscapes, with all the city conveniences yet within range of both mountain hikes and a beautiful Atlantic coast. It's perfect for work and family life. Elevate your career with Nurse Anesthesia of Maine. Visit www.namecrna.com for more information. That's www.namecrna.com. So next, let's talk about chronic kidney disease, or CKD. And CKD is a slow, progressive, and irreversible disease in the functioning of the nephrons. A decreased renal blood flow, decreased GFR, tubular function slowly decreases. And CKD is staged based upon the GFR level. When patients become less than 60 on their GFR, 60 milliliters per minute per 1.73 meters squared, that level, when they get below 60, that's the triggering level for chronic kidney disease. And it continues through different stages until you get all the way down to less than 15 on your GFR. And in that case, patients then need dialysis and they're classified as end-stage renal failure. Now, side effects from the chronic kidney disease include normal prohromic normocytic anemia, increased platelet dysfunction, which means increased bleeding time, hypertension from chronic the renin system activation, and acidosis as well. Patients that have CKD also can have hypocalcemia and hyperparathyroidism, and is common in these patients. And while there can be multiple electrolyte abnormalities, hyperkalemia is one of the more serious alterations that we see in renal failure patients. And this is because both the inability of the nephrons to secrete potassium in exchange for the sodium and calcium, as well as the systemic acidosis that's causing an increase in the serum potassium levels. So it's kind of multifactorial there, but we need to be very mindful of these patients' potassium levels, especially before we do anesthesia on them. So preoperatively, for anesthesia considerations, we need to evaluate their renal function in terms of where are they at, what stage are they at, what are their laboratory values showing in terms of the BUN, serum creatinine, creatinine clearance, what's your GFR level. We need to verify any recent potassium levels, ideally within the last 6 to 8 hours of the procedure, and the last time they had dialysis, if they do receive dialysis. We should be mindful of these patients about giving medications that have any sort of renal excretion or active metabolites, and we need to minimize those. So, for example, morphine, bupivacaine, hydromorphone, those are all ones that have active metabolites. Morphine has two metabolites, and they're excreted by the kidney, and they can build up and cause respiratory depression in these patients. Bupivacaine is metabolized into norepinephrine, which can then cause convulsions. So just know with patients that have chronic renal disease, if we're giving medications that have active metabolites that are excreted by the kidneys, we should plan or expect that we're going to have a buildup of those active metabolites. Intraoperatively, electrocardiograms should be used, as always, of every patient, but we should be specifically watching for signs of hyperkalemia with such as peaked T waves, prolonged PR intervals, absent P waves with a widened QRS complex. And due to the anemia of these patients, we really need to make sure we're avoiding hypoxia, as any further reduction than an oxygen delivery can be dangerous because they already don't have as much hemoglobin to carry the oxygen to begin with. So now if we cause the patient to become more hypoxic, we're just adding fuel to the fire here. And it's a slippery slope in terms of reducing that oxygen delivery in a hurry. In terms of vascular volume and fluid replacement, this is really guided the most accurately if we have a central venous pressure monitoring or an ART line. And if we're going to do one of those, specifically for an ART line, lower extremity arterial line, such as a femoral ART line, is often used in these patients. And that's because of either the vessels that are going to be used in upper extremities for any type of vascular shunts, if we're going to have fistulas, et cetera, moving forward or not already. And if the volume deficit during the perioperative period, if it's expected to be more than 10 to 15% of the blood volume of the patient, then it's recommended that you go ahead and do the invasive monitoring. That's going to be justified here. So again, 10 to 15% of the patient's total blood volume, if that's expected to be lost during the perioperative period, then you're justified in doing that invasive monitoring. In terms of fluid replacement, it should be replaced with a balanced salt solution with no potassium and small amounts of chloride. Typically 5 to 10 milliliters per kilogram of 5% glucose and water, so D5W, is given to replace the fluid loss. And then for any urine that's produced, the urine amount is replaced with 0.5% saline or 0.5% saline. Albumin then is also recommended for any significant volume replacement that's going to be needed. In terms of getting the patient into as best of a position possible from a fluid standpoint before the procedure, dialysis is recommended on the day before anesthesia. And this is to allow time for equilibrium of that fluid with any electrolyte shifts that is occurring after the dialysis. And then in terms of your anesthetic plan, regional anesthesia is a great option for these patients, especially because then we'll be limiting the amount of intravenous drug use that we're going to be doing, potential drugs that have active metabolites that are going to last longer in these patients before getting excreted. But you can also do a general as well. But if regional is not contraindicated, that is a great option. We don't want to put IVs in forearms if these patients may need dialysis in the near future. And then due to these patients potentially having less albumin levels, any high protein bound drugs are going to have an increased effect. So some examples would be ketamine and benzodiazepine medications. So just know that if you're going to be giving those, they're going to last a little bit longer. They're going to have, the patient's going to be more sensitive to those medications. Propofol and dexmedetomidine are widely used in these patients successfully. They're good drugs to use. And in terms of volatile anesthetics, they can harm the kidneys due to an increase in the free fluoride ions, but it's not as big of a deal nowadays of modern inhalational anesthetics. But we just know that these patients are more prone to the hypotension that's going to result because they typically are more hypertensive to begin with and chronically hypertensive. So just be mindful of the hypotension that's going to develop from that volatile anesthetic. And then lastly, in terms of neuromuscular blocking agents, succinylcholine can increase serum potassium by 0.5 milliequivalents per liter. And succinylcholine use is still considered safe in these patients as long as the serum potassium level is under 5.5 milliequivalents per liter and the patient has undergone dialysis within the last 24 hours. We can also give sesagocurium and atricurium, and that's due to them being organ independent for their elimination. But atricurium causes histamine release. So typically, if we're going to do one of the two of these, sesagocurium or Nimbex is the preferred one. And we stay away from long-acting muscle relaxants as much as possible in these patients. So vecuronium and pancuronium are often avoided. And that leaves us with rocuronium. And rocuronium is probably one of the more common neuromuscular blocking agents that we give. And the rocuronium clearance is going to be reduced by roughly 39% in these renal failure patients, which significantly is going to prolong the duration of action. However, though, studies show that with sugammadex dosed at 4 milligrams per kilogram, patients are safely reversed and we're able to use rocuronium for these patients in a safe manner. Just know, though, that the sugammadex rocuronium complex that's formed there, so that sugammadex wraps around the rocuronium molecules, and those complexes are then going to be removed through dialysis as long as a high-flux hemodialysis method is used. So just make sure you're aware ahead of time. You talk through what dialysis they use, make sure it's a high-flux, and then there's no issues at all with the sugammadex and rocuronium complex being excreted there. Next, we want to move into electrolyte imbalances, fluid imbalance for these patients. And we do have a whole other episode that we walk through the fluid levels inside of our bodies in terms of extracellular to intracellular, et cetera. So feel free to go check that episode out for more specifically on that. But I briefly want to touch on with these patients if they do become fluid overloaded. So if they have too much fluid in their vascular space, these patients can develop this overload either due to an over-administration of excess fluids, or there's just simply the decreased urine output. And if they haven't got dialysis recently, oftentimes if you have a patient that misses one or two sessions of dialysis, they'll become fluid overloaded and they'll have this symptomatic response of congestive heart failure picture. And it'll present such as pulmonary edema, decreased cardiac output, you have systemic peripheral edema, et cetera, very short of breath. And often this is first line treated with diuretics such as furosemide or Lasix. And it's often given as the first line treatment, which would then increase the urine output and decrease the fluid buildup. And in end-stage renal failure patients, often then emergent dialysis will be needed to pull off that excess fluid. And again, if you want more information on the breakdown of different fluid compartments, et cetera, I encourage you to go over to our fluid episode where we walk through all of that. But for the rest of this talk, we really want to focus on the electrolyte imbalances.
The first electrolyte imbalance we're going to talk about is sodium. So normal value for sodium is 135 to 145 milliequivalents per liter. First, let's talk about hyponatremia. So hyponatremia is going to be the most common electrolyte abnormality that we see with hospitalized patients. And again, this would be a plasma level of less than 135 milliequivalents per liter. So when we're talking about the level here in the plasma compared to the intracellular environment, we see that water will tend to flow out of the plasma and into the intracellular space, trying to basically cause this equilibrium to be in place. So if we have too low of a sodium, so think about the solutes in the plasma there, if we have fluid move into the intracellular space, then by definition, that will increase the concentration of sodium there. The problem with that is we can see shifts throughout the body that would cause issues. Primarily think about if we have this shift happening in the brain, we can see cerebral edema and associated issues happening with the edema there with seizures and other complications. Signs and symptoms that we can see with hyponatremia will include nausea. You can see lethargy, headache. You can see altered level of consciousness. If we have sodium that falls below 115 milliequivalents per liter, you're at higher risk for seizures, coma. You can see even respiratory arrest and cerebral herniation at this point. So there's definitely levels to it, depending on, you know, the different level that the sodium is at. Obviously, the further down you get from a normal value, the more, you know, alarming the signs and symptoms become. But it's important that we keep an eye on the sodium levels for you know, these different symptoms as we're moving away from that normal value before we get to those points. When we see a loss in sodium, that can happen from a lot of different things, but think about your diuretics that are causing increase in urine output, but also you could be seeing a loss of sodium there as well. Addison's disease, if you have severe vomiting, diarrhea, or SIADH, symptom of inappropriate ADH, then you can also see a decrease in sodium there as well. You can also see hyponatremia because of a dilution effect. So think about if you have a very hypervolemic patient, you can see this with congestive heart failure, cirrhosis, even renal failure, where you have an increase in volume and thereby diluting out the sodium, causing a hyponatremia. In order to treat hypervolemic hyponatremia, you can give vasopressin receptor antagonists. Those would be things such as tolvaptan and conivaptan, which will increase the free water excretion. You want to be very careful here, though, with rapid correction of serum sodium. It's dangerous because primarily of the risk for seizures and a demyelination of the neurons there. So when we're treating this, we will want to restrict the fluid. Obviously, if we're hypervolemic, then we want to reduce the amount of fluids that we're giving these patients. And then also you can give them diuretics to try to increase the serum sodium. And again, you don't want to do this by more than 1 to 2 milliequivalents per liter. You can give an infusion of 3% saline at a rate to 1 to 2 mils per kilo per hour as well. That hypertonic solution, if we have a patient that, for like a clearer picture, you think about them with a very hypotonic plasma because they have a decrease in that sodium, giving them a hypertonic solution, again, slowly would also be an appropriate action here. Talking about anesthesia for these patients that have hypovolemic hyponatremia, you can see hypotension with these patients. You can give them fluid therapy. We mentioned that already. Vasopressors and inotropes may be required for these patients as well. If possible, we want to try to correct the hyponatremia before surgery, before we go back. But keep in mind, these patients might have serious issues there with hypotension. On the other side of things, we want to talk about hypernatremia. So this would be a sodium level of greater than 145 milliequivalents per liter. Typically, we see this because of dehydration, basically just through limited free water intake for the patient. You will see that the different paths here, depending on how this onset occurs. So if we see an increase in sodium that is very rapid, then the brain cells will shrink, and that can cause traction on the cerebral vasculature, and that increases the risk there for intracranial hemorrhage. The signs and symptoms for this would include confusion. You can see weakness, hyperreflexia, seizures as well. Treatment for this would be to give free water administration to replace the deficit, which would be calculated based on the sodium. So this would look like the concentration divided by 140 minus 1 times the total body weight would be the calculation there for addressing how much free water we would be using to replace that deficit. We'll use isotonic crystalloids until the circulating volume is restored. And then at that point, we're going to give hypotonic solutions to try to correct that water deficit. Again, with the correction here, you're going to want to try to decrease the sodium by 1 to 2 milliequivalents per liter per hour. You're not trying to do this all at one time. If we're doing anesthesia with these patients, if possible, again, we would like to correct the sodium level prior to surgery. If these patients are severely dehydrated and hypovolemic, then we will want to pay very close attention while we're inducing these patients and during the maintenance of anesthesia to try to correct the hypotension that happens. You can deal with fluids, vasopressors. You might even need inotropes there as well.
So next, let's talk about potassium levels. And potassium is the main intracellular electrolyte. And in the plasma, potassium is normally between 3.5 and 5.0 milliequivalents per liter. And hypokalemia is when the serum potassium is less than that 3.5 milliequivalents per liter mark. And it can be caused from either an absolute deficiency via vomiting, diarrhea, renal loss, and endocrinology alterations, poor intake, medication use such as thiazide diuretics, or intracellular shifts. And what I mean by intracellular shifts is involves potassium moving from the plasma into the cells. And it does this when we have alkalosis. If there's insulin, insulin will pull the potassium into the cells. Beta adrenergic stimulation will cause this. And signs and symptoms of hypokalemia include palpitations, skeletal muscle weakness. For a mild decrease in potassium, we'll see this. And then when you get to potassium less than 2.5 milliequivalents per liter, signs and symptoms then will include paresthesia, a depressed deep tendon reflex, altered level of consciousness, and dysrhythmias such as a first and second degree heart block, and then atrial and ventricular fibrillation and asystole. The EKG can also show ST segment depression, a flattened T wave, and then one of the more telltale signs is the presence of a U wave as well. Treatment for this is going to include, obviously, an IV administration of potassium. We can give up to 40 milliequivalents per hour. If you're giving potassium, also give chloride, which helps the kidneys conserve the potassium as well. During anesthesia, potassium replacement can be given for these patients. Additionally, any further decrease in potassium should be avoided by avoiding the administration of insulin, glucose, beta-adrenergic agonist, bicarbonate, diuretics. We want to avoid causing alkalosis, so avoid hyperventilation, for example. And there's also going to be a prolonged action of potentially the muscle relaxants because of that skeletal muscle weakness with the alteration in potassium. So just know that the neuromuscular blocking agents may have a prolonged duration of action. So just be watching the train of four, whatever you're using, to determine how weak the patient is. In terms of hyperkalemia, this is when the serum potassium is over the 5.0 milliequivalents per liter. And it can be caused by an impaired renal excretion, if you have a high potassium intake, if you have medications such as ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, beta blockers. And another cause would be an extracellular shift in this case. And this is when the potassium is moving from the inside of the cells out into the plasma. And this can be caused by acidosis, digitalis toxicity, and succinylcholine administration are three examples of that. So signs and symptoms are going to include EKG changes such as peak T waves, PR prolongation, flattened P wave, QRS prolongation, a sine wave pattern, and then ventricular fibrillation or cardiac arrest. Treatment for this is going to involve stabilizing those cardiac membranes and intracellular shifting then of the potassium, trying to get the potassium to move back into the cells and then removing potassium from the body. One of the ways that we can do this is by giving insulin and dextrose, which can cause intracellular shifting. Buterol is another example of this as well. And if you have a patient that's going to be going under anesthesia that has hyperkalemia, ideally the potassium should be less than 5.5 milliequivalents per liter for any type of elective surgery. Obviously, if you're doing an emergent case and you don't have time to correct this beforehand, then immediate interventions to lower the potassium should be put into place right away before induction. Avoid succinylcholine, as this will increase by the potassium by roughly half a milliequivalent per liter. Avoid acidosis, as this is going to increase hyperkalemia as well. And then avoid potassium-containing fluid. So like lactate ringers have potassium in it as well. So just try to avoid any type of fluid that would have potassium.
All right, next let's move into calcium. Calcium is mostly found in the bones, 99% of this. The remaining 1% is going to be in plasma and the body cells. Most of the calcium that we see in the plasma is bound to anions or proteins such as albumin. The remaining free calcium there in the plasma is known as the ionized fraction of calcium. Total plasma calcium is normally 9 to 10.5 milligrams per deciliter. And another thing to note here is that the parathyroid hormone and vitamin D will work to increase calcium from the bones into the bloodstream and increase the absorption of calcium from the intestines and conserve calcium from the kidneys. So there's three main spots that we're going to see the parathyroid hormone and vitamin D working to increase calcium: bones, and we'll also see that with the intestines that we're absorbing, and then finally conserving that from the kidneys as well. Hypocalcemia, so think less than 9 milligrams per deciliter. Intraoperatively, most commonly we see this from hyperventilation and massive transfusions. So hyperventilation will cause an alkalosis picture, which will cause more calcium to bind to the proteins, and that will reduce the ionized calcium. Remember, the ionized calcium is the free calcium that is not bound to the proteins. With the massive transfusions, remember that citrate is a preservative impact red blood cells that will bind to calcium and will decrease again the free ionized calcium. And so when we have massive transfusions, then we have less of this free ionized calcium available of this blood that we've been transfusing because of that citrate. And so that's another reason that you would see the decreased levels there and the hypocalcemia. Other causes that we can see is hypoparathyroidism. You can see vitamin D insufficiency and also parathyroid hormone resistance. Again, remember that we see with those that will have better reabsorption from the bones, we'll see better reabsorption from the gut and also from the kidneys. And if we have issues there with your hypoparathyroidism and also vitamin D insufficiency, then we're going to have a decreased available level of calcium there. Signs and symptoms will include muscle weakness, think tetany. You can see the Chostovec sign, so that's facial and eye muscle twitching. You can see a Trousseau sign as well. Hyperreflexia, you can see broncho or laryngospasm. Bradycardia, even cardiac arrest. You'll see QT prolongation as well. Treatment for hypocalcemia is going to be giving calcium chloride or calcium gluconate. Calcium chloride should be given through a central venous line, because if you have the infiltrate, you can see very, very bad issues there with tissue necrosis. But also if you're giving it through a peripheral vein, it could also just cause some venous irritation there as well. Keep in mind also with anesthesia, if you are giving multiple packed cells, know that if the patient is hypothermic, if they have liver disease or renal failure, that will impair the citrate clearance and that will cause further hypocalcemia as well. Another situation that we should be very keen on watching for hypocalcemia is if we're doing a procedure with the thyroid or the parathyroid, then there's an issue there where you could see issues with hypocalcemia there immediately post-op with the removal of the thyroid or the parathyroid. Primarily, we're thinking about the parathyroid. Again, remember that the parathyroid hormone is going to be very important for the calcium levels. So for removing the parathyroid or even a thyroid, there's still potential risk here for seeing those low calcium levels. Hypercalcemia. So this is the opposite side. If we have too much movement of calcium from the bone into the bloodstream and that will exceed our kidney's ability to excrete calcium, then you can see this increased level of calcium in the body. Over half of the cases are caused by primary hyperparathyroidism, and malignancy is going to be the second most common cause for a patient presenting with hypercalcemia. Signs and symptoms here, you'll see fatigue, confusion, seizures. You can see hypertension, and you can also see severe bradycardia as well. For treating this, you want to give normal saline to increase the blood volume and try to dilute that calcium level as well. And it will also aid in excreting more urine and excreting more calcium. You can also give loop diuretics to try to increase your renal excretion. If there's a rapid increase in calcium, then the answer here is going to be emergent hemodialysis to filter out that calcium. For anesthesia, our goal here is to restore intravascular volume before induction and to increase urinary excretion by giving a loop diuretic to try to decrease the amount of calcium, increase the amount of excretion of calcium there in the kidneys.
So last, we want to talk about magnesium levels, and hypomagnesium in the serum is any serum magnesium under 1.5 milliequivalents per liter. And this can be caused by renal losses, pregnancy, poor intake, excessive alcohol intake, gastrointestinal losses, and medications such as diuretics, aminoglycosides, and et cetera. Now, hypomagnesium alters the cardiac resting membrane potential, which results in a flat T wave, U waves, prolonged QT intervals, widened QRS complexes, and arrhythmias. And treatment is going to include giving 1 to 2 grams of magnesium sulfate over 5 minutes, and then 1 to 2 grams per hour after that. Anesthesia management for these patients includes giving magnesium supplementation, as I just talked about, and then treating any associated hypokalemia or hypocalcemia that often is kind of seen with the lower magnesium level. Hypomagnesium is also associated with muscle weakness and muscle excitation. So you really follow the peripheral nerve stimulation for how to redose muscle relaxant during these procedures. And then lastly, do not fluid overload these patients, because magnesium passively follows sodium excretion in the kidneys. So if you give too much fluid and the sodium starts to be excreted out, the magnesium will follow and it'll drop that level even more. And then to end with hypermagnesium levels, this is any serum concentration over 3 milliequivalents per liter, and it's most often caused by an over-administration of magnesium, but can also be caused by renal failure and adrenal insufficiency. So I'm gonna use the lab values of milligrams per deciliter now moving forward. So at 4 to 5 milligrams per deciliter, patients can have a decrease in their deep tendon reflexes. And when you get to 5 to 7 milligrams per deciliter, hypotension is going to start to really develop, and that loss of deep tendon reflexes. And you get up to 10 milligrams per deciliter, and you're going to start to have respiratory paralysis, a coma-like state. As you get to 10 to 15 milligrams per deciliter, you're going to start to have heart block, and further increases can result in cardiac arrest. And so we don't want to get to this point, obviously. And so treatment is by stopping the administration of magnesium. So whenever we're giving magnesium to patients in the hospital, we want to be watching for these earlier signs of toxicity level before, so we can catch it before we get to the more severe. Once we do realize that, we need to stop the magnesium. And then if it's to the point where we are concerned about any type of cardiac events happening, you can give calcium chloride to stabilize the cardiac membrane. And then anesthesia management for these patients are going to include being mindful that there's going to be increased hypotension and vasodilation from this increased magnesium level. Any type of acidosis is going to exacerbate the hypermagnesium and the signs and symptoms of that. So we want to limit acidosis. And then know that skeletal muscle weakness is also noted. So these patients may need to be weaned from a ventilator in an intensive care unit after the procedure. That's not unheard of. And that wraps us up for talking through renal complications, acute renal failure, chronic renal failure, and then some of the fluid and electrolyte abnormalities that we might see and how best to adapt our anesthesia to provide the best care for those patients.